previously on Popping Collars.
It just occurred to me also that, Liz, that you're what, canon to the ordinary?
Right.
So you're like the fixer, aren't you? In the diocese, you're like have to go. Are you like the fixer?
No, I mean historically, that's what the canon is. You mean so? Yes. I'm really not. We're a way more collaborative team than that. But historically, that is what the canon to the ordinary was.
Yeah,
that would be amazing if your business card just said fixer.
I wish I was that much of a badass. It's not.
I just picture you rolling in like the wolf from Pulp Fiction. Right, right? Yeah. Like, what's the problem? How can I help?
Okay, somebody's been kidnapped. They want how much money? All right, just get it. Get it.
So we'll do this. Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture. I'm your host. My name is Greg Knight. I'm in Palm Beach, Florida. With me are my co-hosts, Betsy Gonzalez from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome back, Betsy.
Hello, Greg.
Liz Easton from Omaha, Nebraska. Hello, Liz.
Hey, Greg.
And our special guest for this episode, Lucas Mix from Princeton, New Jersey. Welcome to the show, Lucas.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about a little bit more serious of a topic than we usually do, internet pornography. Now, I don't think that the goal of our show is to shame anyone right out of the box. I recognize that there's a thriving adult film industry in this country and many people that work in it that are proud of what they do and the work they create for their fans. What we're specifically trying to talk about is this phenomenon of internet pornography. More and more sites have become amateur operations, luring young women and men into quite frankly, the world of abuse, exploitation, sometimes sexual slavery, and the top free internet sites average more hits per day than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined. So there are a lot of people consuming pornography in this country, and it can be assumed that we work with a lot of them. So my question to the group is, where is the best place to start a moral conversation about internet porn? Is it with the producers or is it with the consumers?
Well, I think maybe, Greg, maybe some terminology before we start.
Sure, that helps too.
That helps
a little
too.
Groundwork.
What I liked when we were kind of talking about this before is that Lucas, you really brought this up. So kind of when we think about how we're going to talk about this, how do you parse out what it is that we're actually speaking of?
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to start with this idea that there is such a thing as erotica, which is media that is designed to arouse people. And there's also a concept of pornography, which is unchaste or really unrighteous types of sexual behavior. And we can ask this question of, are there types of erotica that might be healthy, or is all erotica pornography?
I grew up in a time, you know, the 90s. You know, at a time like in my diocese, we had sex camp, which is not necessarily having sex at camp. But when you are in high school, every 3 years, it would be this kind of spirituality of sexuality camp session, right? And you'd have a nurse there. You'd have people who were married, people who were single. You know, the staff was larger, just more intense and interesting conversations in your kind of small groups and all that stuff. And that there was really this kind of saying, you know, your body and your sexuality and who you are and how you express yourself as a sexual person is a gift from God. And how you then choose to share that with others is a gift that should be treasured and valued. When I find stepping into this conversation, you know, I feel Greg's feeling of, I don't want to sit here and shame people. But at the same time, I also am stepping into this as a person who works predominantly with high school students. And I'm very concerned with how they are developing who they are as that sexual being. Who is that person? How do they express themselves? How are they using or not using digital media to not only gain information about sex itself and other random other sex acts and things like that that you might go looking for because it showed up in a Cards Against Humanity game and you don't know what it means? But how are you also developing a digital idea of who you are as a sexual person? You know, that Kim Kardashian can post a photo of herself in the way she wants to. You know, can't I do that too? And so how are they making choices around that. You know, it reminds me of when we had, I remember in college, the purity test was really big. There was this big, long thing that was on a listserv. Children of the Listserv is a chat room that I'm not even going to try. But, you know, and it listed all of these different things, and you take it to kind of see what your purity was, right? But it was filled with things like some of the questions. I'm like, I don't know what that means. Now I would go to the internet and Google it, and I would figure out what it means. And so in the absence of other voices talking, how are our young people building their identity in this way? That's where I'm concerned with the consumer in that way.
Right. Totally agree with the absence of people talking, because that's where I feel like we kind of drop the ball a lot when it comes to youth ministry, is that, you know, and especially at the parish level. So Betsy's situation is a little more unique from mine, where you've got them at school, you're involved in their daily life.
Their daily routine. Right there.
I get them every Sunday with their parents, right? So I have some boundary depending on what a family dynamic is and what a family is willing to talk about in their own circle. Kind of affects what it is that I'm able to talk about in the parish with children. And that can vary widely. You've got parents that are totally okay with having conversations about sexuality. You've got parents that feel like it is totally inappropriate to have sexual conversations at church. And so where do you find yourself making a framework for a moral ethic about sexuality for kids then when they come to church? You just sort of say, well, let's just not talk about it. And then you've removed the church voice from the conversation from that point forward. I think that's a mistake, ultimately.
There are other voices who are having this conversation for us, right, in the Christian world. And it does not necessarily have the same celebration of sexuality and of being created in the image of God and of all of that beauty and wonder that we would like to be having in our churches. So the virginity pledges and the tons of shame probably about viewing pornography at all for younger kids. And that's the part that sort of scares me. And I don't have children, and I don't know a whole lot about, you know, kind of psychological development, but there's a degree to which the young people, and I'm going to say boys, even though I know that girls look at pornography too, but the way that young boys are consuming this media, maybe in a way that they are not at all understanding even what they're about to see and what's about to happen to their body in response to what they're about to see, and you know, how they're going to be formed and changed by that encounter. You know, there's a degree to which the consumers are being victimized too, but at a certain age, I think that's really true.
I was going to say, I work with college students, and it's really interesting because they were coming to a time when they come to college, they've already probably had at least 5 years access to internet sites with regard to sex and sexuality. Many of them have not been able to talk with their parents or not been able to talk at their church about these topics. And so I feel like in some ways I'm trying to catch up with them. They've had all of this work that they've had to do on their own. And so I'm very invested in this question of how the church can be having a conversation with people about how they view sexuality earlier, so that the things that they get on the internet are not the only things. And I think it's very difficult because there's a lot of unhealthy stuff out there. You wouldn't let your kid loose in Las Vegas without parental supervision, but somehow they have access to the internet. So how do we give them the tools they need to deal with these things that they're going to run into?
So the other side of this, right, the flip side of this for me is, you know, I want to be sort of this gung-ho, like, yeah, we should have this conversation. We should have this conversation with our youth. And then the legal side of my brain starts firing up and saying, wait, what about safeguarding God's children? Like, why are you making this an issue? We're in trouble if we go down this path. Like, all of this stuff, right? Like, this idea that there are healthy conversations to be had and there are unhealthy conversations to be had. And if you put the wrong person in that situation where they're having the unhealthy conversations and they end up going down a bad road, like, all of a sudden, I've got to justify why I had a youth leader talking to a girl about pornography to the vestry, and I don't want to have that conversation, right? And so it's easy just to avoid it. And so, yeah, so I can see sort of the church world being at war with itself about this.
Well, it becomes the invisibility of the conversation. You know, that then things become invisible. Because if we don't know how to talk about them. Like, we've even talked about this inside our own community, that, you know, sometimes it seems to be easier to say you're gay than to be gay. Like, what does being gay look like in high school? And how does that look? And are people are okay with you standing in the chapel and making a, you know, impassioned, awesome chapel talk about your being gay and coming out, and then everyone's like, yay! But then if you want to go kind of hold hands with your boyfriend, everyone starts to get a little weird. So then we don't talk about it. So, and I find that gay or straight relationships, as an adult, I feel like I'm prying at sometimes. You know, I feel like I'm asking too much. I'm delving into an area where maybe I haven't been invited. It's like going for the big hug when all they want is the side hug or a fist bump, you know? And you're like, I don't want to overstep my boundaries. But then everything becomes invisible. Nothing becomes talked about. And porn in particular has an underground, alone quality to it. You know, I remember the movie with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Don Juan. You know, he had an entire ritual around how he would watch porn and how it was woven into the fabric of his life and when he would do it and how it shaped the women that he would look for and how it shaped how he thought relationships should be. But it was all so knit into the fabric of his being and in his daily ritual that to actually not do that, it was like giving up smoking. It was like giving up drinking. It was like all of those things. But it was an alone behavior. It was something he did on his own, and it didn't, in his mind, connect to other things when actually it did. And then I find that often some of, you know, the choices our young people make when they're alone or they feel alone are sometimes ones that are not what you would want for them.
Right. And also, it's not just about young people, right? I mean, oh, I think that part of the way that we're making the conversation safe for us is to be like, oh, thank God.
I'm talking about the kids.
Yeah, and that's not at all, you know, that's not
you're
the
right.
case at
you're
all.
You're totally right. So make it unsafe, Liz. Make it unsafe. Come on, Lucas.
I think the comparison to addiction really stands out for me. I've read some things recently that suggest that people are addicted not because of some internal brain chemistry per se, but because they don't have enough connections with other people, and that opens them up to addictions. And so I think young and old people both in our culture don't feel connected enough to others. So there's this strong desire to connect to other people, and sex always seems like a very intense way. So I wonder to what extent porn is people trying to fill in a hole because they're not connected enough with other people. And I feel like the church should have something to say about that, that healthy connections is something the church should be able to talk about, that's part of the good news.
I mean, I grew up in the Episcopal Church and had no framework whatsoever for talking about sexuality or making sexual decisions. I mean, not even a little bit. And when I was in college, this might be going off the rails a little bit, but I attended a Catholic student group where we studied John Paul II's Theology of the Body. Because, you know, it's a bunch of young adults who are really serious about their faith sitting around talking about sex all the time. So it was great. I mean, in that way, it was a big group, big study group. And it had a, kind of a maybe a purity and shame dynamic that wasn't really where I was at or where I am now. But it was probably my first exposure to systematic theology or something that looked like it. And the Catholic Church could really talk about sex in a way that was kind of beautiful and did give you a framework for making decisions. And my life in the Episcopal Church didn't have any of that at all. And in fact, I remember lots of conversations with Lucas Mix in seminary. I mean, so then I was in my mid-20s, like still really trying to figure this out and not having the resources that I needed or the guidance.
I'm curious about this idea of connection that you brought up, Lucas, because I think that what strikes me about porn sites themselves is that there doesn't seem to be much connection at all. And, you know, the thing about internet pornography is that it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. You're just slammed with as much input as possible. And do you want this? And do you want that category? And do you want this category? And, you know, it's so pervasive. And there's no sense that at some point there's, for me anyway, as an outsider looking at this, there's no sense that there's even people there. I mean, it's really just boxes of genitalia, you know, it makes me wonder, like, this sense of deep connection that we're saying people are maybe trying to look for or fill a hole, you know, there doesn't seem to be connection in the product itself, right? So what are people trying to connect to?
My suspicion is, first, we've got all these chemicals like dopamine that shoot through us when we interact with other people, but can also be stimulated by when we are aroused. And so I think some aspect of it might just be chemical. And another thing is, arousal is a very intense experience. And I wonder if people use it in the same way they use drugs in order to swamp out their emotional issues. Like, it allows them to stop thinking about it for a while.
But what is scary to me is when that chemical reaction that you just mentioned, Lucas, becomes linked in a deep way within our brains and bodies with degradation of another human being.
Yeah, because I feel like we're seeking intimacy. I mean, and that's, you know, when you find yourself in a healthy sexual relationship, you know, there's not only a physical connection, but emotional connection. And often when those relationships break down, it's because perhaps one is becoming more than the other, or someone feels they can't have the physical intimacy without the emotional intimacy. You know, have sex with somebody angry, have sex with somebody, you know, it's just, you know, that may be your thing. It's fine, whatever. But I think that element of when it starts to be linked with, I agree with Liz, that violence,
right,
or that someone else needs to be degraded in order to make you feel superior, you know, particularly pornography that is shot from the perspective of the person who is the inflictor of the degradation, you know, so that you can feel like you're that powerful person. You're the one who's inflicting that, and that becomes a part of how you get off.
Mm-hmm.
I think that becomes more troubling, you know, as we think about young people in their formation, but as we think about what gets people off.
You know, what are you doing with pornography if not sort of finding that boundary? Oh, that worked. Well, now that boundary doesn't work anymore. Now I've got to move it further. And now I've got to move it further. And now I've got to move it further. Until the point where you're just not even making it. So now you've got to go to, like, deep web stuff. Now, you know, you keep moving yourself along to the point that you're fracturing whatever kind of intimacy you could even have with another person, because it's not fulfilling that sexual desire that the porn is forcing you down the road of, like, one step, next step, next step, next step. It's becoming the thing that's breaking you.
You can burn yourself out.
Well, and you can burn yourself out, right? Like, I remember reading an article a couple of years ago in New York Magazine or something about teenage boys' sexuality and, you know, how it was influenced by pornography and things like it. And they were saying that, like, a ton, I don't have any numbers, but, like, younger and younger and younger men are experiencing dysfunction in the bedroom, are not being able to achieve orgasm anymore with a real life human woman because they literally, like, burned out parts of how their body experiences sex. That seems crazy, right? And Lucas, you're a scientist. You can tell me if
scientist. Oh, excellent. Thank God.
I worry about some of the scare tactics. So I don't want to go there, but I, at the same time, there's this conditioning question that stands out for me. Like, if you're really used to always getting aroused by one particular thing, especially if it's about domination or fetishes or some, you know, something that you're not normally going to encounter in a relationship, then I think you can condition yourself so that you expect those things and they become tied together in your mind. I want to be careful that it's not this horror story that you have somehow destroyed your purity and are no longer worthy of good company.
That's not what I
But there's a lot of that out there. So,
but I would say that purity thing, you know, that's the Christian church attitude. Like, that's what I grew up with in sort of conservative rural North Carolina, right? Repress. Wear your purity ring. You're going to be fine. And on your wedding night, you know, figure it out. Like, there's got to be a happy medium, right? And we're good Episcopalians. We can find the middle somewhere.
Is the church okay with erotica? Or is that okay?
I think that's something the Episcopal Church is almost actively avoiding dealing with, because it's going to require us to have a common theology of sexuality. And the Episcopal Church is not good at having a common theology. We say we have common practices.
Right.
So fitting this question, it would be easiest just to say, oh, well, we have the practice of marriage. But for my part, I think there's a whole lot of how we think of ourselves and how we express ourselves in terms of our sexuality that it is not just sex.
Right.
And so this is opening up this question of what do we say to people about their sexuality outside of just sex? And that's become a real issue as we start dealing with gender and orientation over the last 10, 15 years.
Well, how diverse that is, how much of our gender and our sexuality and who we are is on a spectrum, much in the same way where we fall as a church on many issues is on a spectrum as well. Well, and it's also the idea of moving out of this binary idea that it's this or it's that. I'm male or I'm female, or I'm gay or I'm straight, or I'm 100% a girl in the way that this box thinks I should be, or I'm a boy, you know, or how I have my sexual identity, what that looks like for me, and moving beyond that. And I think we've begun to have some of that conversation.
There is an industry that produces erotica and produces things that people who make them are proud of, right? There is an industry that does that. But I think that there is a large industry that just sees young men and women as bodies that they can use to get a video onto the internet, and they don't care anymore from that point forward. But they're going to tell that person how great they are in the moment so that they can just keep getting these people in the system.
I worry that there is any circumstance in which someone has informed consent to give sex for money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like it's such a serious thing that I'm pretty skeptical of any time someone is willing to provide sex for monetary compensation, because it sets up all of these dangerous precedents and interactions. And I think it really is related to the question of prostitution and this question of whether sex can ever healthfully be a commodity in exchange for money.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also know that I'm, you know, we're sitting here from a point of, you know, white privilege.
Tons of privilege, yeah.
Tons of privilege, mm-hmm. You know, sleeping in it, you know, swimming in it. And it's, you know, that really looks at all of, can look at all of this as choice. You know, choice and participation. And I'm just aware of that as we're talking about this. That a lot of times it's forcing the hand of poverty, but it forces, you know, it forces the hand of desperation. And that's a place where we get to. I mean, you know, when we start to always list the outsiders who Jesus hung out with, prostitutes are always up there. One, two, right? You know, lepers, poor people, women, kids, and prostitutes, tax collectors. You know, that's kind of, you know, they're always there.
Right.
And what was that about for him? You know, it's this embracing of all. And what was that about for him in the way that he was wanting to seek a deeper intimacy with people, in the way that God was seeking a deeper intimacy, is always seeking a deeper intimacy with us. But that to really have in his inner circle women who used to be in the sex trade and having that be known.
For me, it's important to not do the minimization, not do the reduction that we're worried about other people. So you have young women who get sucked into this because it feeds something in their ego. And you have people who are watching this because they feel like they need something. And how do we treat them as people with needs rather than the people who have made choices we disapprove of. Mm-hmm. And for me, a lot of Jesus' willingness and eagerness to associate with people who did all of these different things is that he could always see them as brothers and sisters and not reduce them to what they do or what they make or all of these other questions that distract us.
We do this thing called like 5 minute coffee hour, where if there's some piece of pop culture that you've been like binging on or interested in the last week, you just share it with everyone.
And it's really just a chance to have an unfiltered conversation, yeah, where you can just like kind of joke around with each other.
I binge watched the entire first season of Beverly Hills 90210. Talk about erotica, Dylan McKay, Luke Perry, circa 1995.
With the sideburn and the high
All right. So you've found your way into my wheelhouse. you've unwittingly stumbled into my area of expertise.
Hold on. Now, Liz, is this some sort of retro show for you? Like, what? Let's.
Yeah, so I was not quite, old enough to watch it the first time around, but I do remember seeing it in reruns. And I'm sure I've watched the whole series, but the first season is on Amazon Prime. And then I was like ready to purchase the following season because I was like, Brenda might be pregnant, like, but you can't.
Cliffhanger!
They won't let you. You can't buy it yet, so I don't know.
Was that at the dance?
No, she lost her virginity at the spring dance, and then
is that with the black dress with the white
with the white? Yep.
The elders.
Matthew Perry's in the first season of that show. So the thing that I love about the first season of 90210 is that Brandon meets all of these students that go to West Beverly that you never see again over the course of that show. It's like the lost students of West Beverly.
Has sex with Andrea Zuckerman in this like totally weird proposal. Like it was fascinating. It's great. Great first season.
That is also my wheelhouse as well, Liz.
Really?
It's a great show. There's a priest on that show.
Betsy
knows her.
Oh, yeah.
It's Kelly's mom,
Kelly's mom, the drug addict. Yep. Mm-hmm. Kelly Kapowski's mother.
Not Kelly Kapowski, Kelly Taylor.
Kelly Kapowski.
That was
Saved by the Bell.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Kapowski's a little too ethnic, Kelly Taylor. Let's be honest.
Lucas, did you watch 90210?
I did not watch 90210. I'm much more of a Firefly guy myself. That's what I've been binge-watching.
That's awesome, too.
Joss Whedon. Okay. Yeah. Lucas, do you have a church website, a blog, a Twitter feed, anything that you would like to promote?
I do postmodern Christianity, a lot of science and religion. I did a long series on the ethics of sexuality. So the blog is dacalu.wordpress.com.
It's really good.
Cool.
Awesome. You can find Popping Collars on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/poppingcollars. And you can find all of our shows at poppingcollarspodcast.com. Please feel free to subscribe, rate, and review our show wherever you get our podcasts, especially if it's on iTunes. And a big thank you to episcopalcafe.com for featuring our show each and every time. We love episcopalcafe.com. We know you will as well. Check them out for all of your Episcopal news and beyond. So with that, that's Popping Collars for this time. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Lucas. Thank you, Betsy, for coming on the show. We'll see you next time.
keep those collars popped.